This is Herb Montgomery with Renewed Heart Ministries, and I welcome you to this week's weekly podcast. The title of this series is The Seven Last Sayings of Jesus, and this is going to be part one of nine. And I've entitled this week as Two Definitions of Holiness. And this week, I want to begin this nine-part series. We're doing it leading up to this year's Easter season. And we're going to begin next week taking a look at each one of the last sayings of Jesus that we're given in the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And we're going to begin with Mark and Matthew first, and then we're going to progress from there. But then the week leading up to Easter, we're going to look at what relevance the narrative element of the resurrection may have for us in our world today. And if I'm transparent with you this week, this series has come out of an exercise that I was engaged in personally throughout last year, 2014. Each week is composed of 7 days, and I took one of the last sayings of Jesus each day as the subject of my contemplation. And one saying every day for a whole year, basically. And what I'm about to share very humbly is just simply the fruit of that year-long contemplation. And I want to prepare this series this week by taking a look at what actually put Jesus on the cross to begin with. Jesus' crucifixion and his resurrection in the Gospels comes at the end of a long history of contention that began between the privileged and oppressive priesthood, the Levites, and the prophets who spoke up as advocates for those who the priests were oppressing. For dominating priests, holiness was defined by the purity codes that are attributed to Moses, and sometimes those are referred to as holiness codes. But for the prophets, holiness was defined by not by ritualistic or religious purity, but instead the prophets defined holiness as justice for the oppressed, mercy for the poor, the fatherless, the widows, and the fatherless and the widows specifically held meeting. Remember, ancient Israel was a very patriarchal culture. So you had mercy for the poor, justice for the oppressed, and humility. And the struggle between these two groups began, by most scholars reckoning, with Amos and Isaiah in the 8th century BCE. And that's Isaiah chapters 1 through 39. But here's just a sampling. This is from Amos. This is what the Lord says: "For three sins of Israel, even four, I will not turn back my wrath. They sell the innocent for silver, and the needy for a pair of sandals. They trample on the heads of the poor as the dust on the ground, and deny justice to the oppressed. Father and son use the same girl, and so profane my holy name." That's Amos 2, 6-7. Amos 5, 7 says, "There are those who turn justice into bitterness, and cast righteousness to the ground." Amos 5, 11-12 states, you levy a straw tax on the poor and impose tax on their grain. Therefore, though you have built stone mansions, you will not live in them. Though you have planted lush vineyards, you will not drink their wine. For I know how many are your offenses and how great your sins. There are those who oppress the innocent and take bribes and deprive the poor of justice in the courts." Amos 5, 21-24 says, I despise your religious festivals. I cannot stand your assemblies. Even though you bring me burnt offerings and grain offerings, I will not accept them. Though you bring choice fellowship offerings, I will have no regard for them. Away with the noise of your songs. I will not listen to the music of your harps, but let justice roll on like a river, righteousness like a never-failing stream. In Amos 8, 4-6, Amos wrote, "Hear this, you who trample the needy and do away with the poor of the land, saying, 'When will the new moon be over that we may sell grain, and the Sabbath be ended that we might market wheat? Skimping on the measure, boosting the price, and cheating with dishonest scales, buying the poor with silver and the needy for a pair of sandals, selling even the sweepings with the wheat.'" Notice in Amos, there is this meticulous keeping of the new moon and the Sabbath, the ritual purity codes, but there's an utter disregard for justice towards the poor and the oppressed. Matter of fact, they're taking advantage of the poor and the oppressed. Let's move to Isaiah next. In Isaiah, we find the same thing. In Isaiah 1, 10 through 17, Isaiah writes, "Hear the word of the Lord, you rulers of Sodom, and listen to the instruction of your God, you people of Gomorrah." And I'll stop right there for just a second. Two centuries later, Ezekiel would define the sin of Sodom and Gomorrah as violations of social justice. In Ezekiel 16:49, it says, "Now this was the sin of your sister Sodom. She and her daughters were arrogant, overfed, and unconcerned. They did not help the poor and the needy." So that's a little bit of background for this reference to Sodom, how they were viewed at least within a century, a couple centuries worth of time in this culture. Isaiah goes on, "The multitude of your sacrifices, what are they to me, says the Lord? I have more than enough of burnt offerings, of rams, of the fat of fattened animals. I have no pleasure in the blood of bulls, lambs, or goats. When you come to appear before me, who asks this of you? The trampling of my courts? Stop bringing meaningless offerings. Your incense is detestable to me, new moons, Sabbaths, and convocations. I cannot bear your evil assemblies. Your new moon feasts and your appointed festivals I hate with all my being. They have become a burden to me. I'm weary of bearing them. When you spread out your hands in prayer, I will hide my eyes from you. Even if you offer many prayers, I will not listen. Your hands are full of blood. Wash and make yourself clean. Take your evil deeds out of my sight. Stop doing wrong and learn to do right. Seek justice. Encourage the oppressed. Defend the cause of the fatherless. Plead the case of the widow." In Isaiah 1, verse 21, it says, "She was once," talking about Israel or Judah, "she was once full of justice. Righteousness used to dwell in her, but now murderers." Two verses later in verse 23, it says, "You rulers are rebels, companions of thieves. They all love bribes and chase after gifts. They do not defend the cause of the fatherless. The widow's case does not come before them." In Isaiah 10, 1 through 2, it goes on to say, "Woe to those who make unjust laws, to those who issue oppressive decrees, to deprive the poor of their rights and withhold justice from the oppressed of my people, making widows their prey and robbing the fatherless." In Isaiah 11, 1 through 5, it says, "A shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse. From his roots a branch will bear fruit. The Spirit of the Lord will rest on him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and of might, the Spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord. He will delight in the fear of the Lord. He will not judge by what he sees with his eyes, nor decide by what he hears with his ears, but with justice he will govern the needy. With equity he will give decisions for the poor of the earth. He will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips he will slay the wicked. Justice will be his belt, and integrity the sash around his waist." It's also really interesting to read the rest of Isaiah 11 here too as a metaphorical description in terms of the lion laying down or the wolf laying down with the lamb, a metaphorical description of a new social order where the present dominance order is replaced with a world where oppressors no longer oppress and victims are no longer victimized, but both are transformed and they peacefully coexist. In Isaiah 25, 1 through 4, Isaiah goes on to say, "Lord, you are my God. I will exalt and praise your name. You have been a refuge for the poor, a refuge for the needy in their distress." The next thing we bump into is the history surrounding the Maccabean Revolt. And during the time of the Maccabean Revolt, there was a revival in fidelity to the purity codes and the definition of holiness as fidelity to those codes. And it was during this time that we see not just a return to the priesthood and the sacrifices and this temple fidelity, but we see the birth of the political movement of the Pharisees. And this group was more liberal in their theology. They believed in angels and a resurrection, but they were more strict in their adherence to the purity codes. They stood in alliance with the privileged class of priests, placing the blame of Jerusalem's captivity and foreign oppression on ritual or religious impurity and not keeping the purity codes of Moses. And we have to remember too that the prophets stood in direct conflict with this explanation of Israel's history. They expressed that the captivity was not a result of not following the purity codes, which placed the Levites at the privileged center of that society. But the prophets expressed that captivity was the result of the abuses of the priestly domination culture over the poor, the fatherless, and the widowed. In other words, of the privileged over the oppressed. And then we come to Jesus. By the time Jesus comes on the scene, the priests, along with the Pharisees, they are well entrenched again, just like in the days of the prophets, within a politically and economically oppressive system, with the temple, the priesthood, the sacrifices, and Jerusalem and Judea at the heart of that system. Jesus comes not as a teacher out of Judea or of the priesthood, but rather he comes from the northern region of Galilee, which is far removed from all of that. And Galileans, according to the Pharisees and the priestly class of Judea, they were considered less faithful to, the Galileans were considered less faithful to the ritual purity and holiness codes. And this was as a result, not only of their proximity to the surrounding Hellenistic culture, but also their distance from Jerusalem and the temple and the theological leadership of the Pharisees and the priestly class themselves. And when one understands this history and the history that goes all the way back to the prophets versus the priests, and then you come into Jesus and his standing up to the Pharisees and the priests, along with the political and economic privileges of the priest and the priestly class in Judea in the first century, the fact that Jesus takes up the heritage of the prophets in advocating for the oppressed is really breathtaking. In Luke 4:18, it says, "The Spirit of the Lord is on me." This is Jesus. "The Spirit of the Lord is on me because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners and the recovery of sight for the blind, to set the oppressed free." And just like the prophets before him, in response to the privileged priestly ruling class of his day, Jesus denounces economic oppression. You find this in Luke 6:20-24, Mark 12:40, and Mark 12:43, and Luke 18:3. And just like the prophets before him, in response to the Pharisees defining holiness as strictness to the purity codes of Moses, Jesus stands in solidarity with those that the Pharisees had labeled as unclean by the purity codes, and Jesus defined holiness rather as justice and mercy for those that the Pharisees were marginalizing. You can find this in Matthew 9:11, Matthew 11:19, and Luke 15:1-2. And remember, the Pharisees defined a sinner as a Jew who was not observing the purity codes. That Jesus embraced and ate with these infuriated the Pharisees. Holiness to a Pharisee was exclusive and punitive. Holiness to Jesus was inclusive and restorative. Holiness to a Pharisee, it was defined as strict adherence to a ritual purity code, including the Sabbath, the new moon, the sacrifices, and holiness to Jesus was justice for those the priestly class, along with the Pharisees, were oppressing based on their non-adherence to the purity codes. You can find all of this in John chapter 9, verse 16. And actually, it's interesting to read the whole of chapter 9 with this redefinition of holiness and the redefinition of the term sinner by Jesus, which was away from ritual purity codes to a restoration of justice and mercy toward the oppressed. But you can go back and read John chapter 9 on your own this week. We're not going to take time to read through the whole chapter right here. But holiness to Jesus, again, was justice for those that the Pharisees were marginalizing. And Jesus would offer a way of worshiping their God that completely bypassed the temple, the sacrifices, and the purity codes. It's interesting to read Mark 7:19 in this context as well. Jesus would say in Matthew 12:7, "If you had known what these words mean, I desire mercy, not sacrifice." Again, that's the prophets with their call for mercy rather than sacrifice, which was the call of the privileged priestly class. Jesus says, "You would not have condemned the innocent." Matthew 9:13, "Go and learn what this means. I desire mercy, not sacrifice, for I have not come to call the righteous, but sinners." In other words, not those who are adhering to strict ritual purity codes, but rather those who you've labeled as sinners as a result. And Jesus would take his final stand against the political and the economic oppression with the temple and its rituals at its heart. And his effort, remember, was not to cleanse the temple, but to dismantle the entire system. And for those that believe that holiness was defined as adherence to the ritual purity code with the temple and the sacrifices, Jesus's act would invite to them, they feared that it would invite greater foreign oppression. In their opinion, contrary to the prophets, but in perfect harmony with the Levitical party, the tribe, back in the days of the prophets. It was lackness in adherence to the purity codes that had caused foreign captivity originally. And Jesus is doing away with the temple and its rituals, and they believe that this would surely bring the destruction of the nation at the hands of foreign enemies once again. This is why in John 11:47-50, notice this language. Then the chief priests, notice who it is, and the Pharisees called a meeting of the Sanhedrin. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him, and then the Romans will come and take away both our temple and our nation. See, they feared foreign oppression again. Then one of them named Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, spoke up, "You know nothing at all. You do not realize that it is better for you that one man die for the people than the whole nation perish." So there you have it. There are these two contrasting views again. It was the priests along with the temple police who arrested Jesus. After this meeting, you can find that in Luke 22:52. And it was their privileged way of life that was really at risk. And yet, how twisted is it that their perception was that, number one, they defined holiness as adherence to the ritual purity codes. And number two, the more strict the people were to the purity codes, the more privileged the priest's political and economic place in society became. And then number three, they believed that failure to follow strict ritual purity would invite the punishment of their God. So here's this catch-22. And Jesus was proclaiming the exact opposite. Jesus proclaimed, number one, that holiness, like the prophets proclaimed of old, is justice and equity for the marginalized, the oppressed, the subordinated, and the disadvantaged. Number two, Jesus proclaimed that the dominant system of the present social order, where some are privileged, and in this case it would be the priestly class and the Pharisees, where some are privileged at the subordination and oppression of others, this whole thing must be abandoned. You can find that in Matthew 23. But number three, Jesus was proclaiming that failure to advocate for the marginalized and the oppressed, that would be at the heart of all that would eventually result in the destruction of Jerusalem at the hands of Rome in the future. And how did the ruling class of priests, along with the political party of the Pharisees, how did they respond to Jesus' teaching? Matthew 27:1 tells us, it says, "Early in the morning, all the chief priests and the elders of the people came to the decision to put Jesus to death." I'm going to close this week with a small insight that we get from John's version of the Jesus story. In John 19:31, it says, "Now it was the day of preparation, and the next day was to be a special Sabbath. Because the Jewish leaders did not want the bodies left on the cross during the Sabbath, they asked Pilate to have the legs broken and the bodies taken down." And it's as if right here, we step all the way back into the days of Amos and Isaiah. Once again, there are those who are more concerned with strict adherence to the ritual purity and holiness codes of Moses than this gross act of injustice against this one that they had just lynched. And the story doesn't end, though, with the success of the Pharisees and the priests in murdering Jesus. In the narrative, there's the narrative element of the resurrection. Jesus is God. It stands victoriously against the God of the oppressors in the story. And Jesus's God stands in solidarity with Jesus, as well as with the prophets, in bringing Jesus back to life, overturning and undoing the lynching of Jesus over and against the political and economic oppression of Jesus's day. But we'll get there. I'll save that all of that for part 9. We'll get there in about 8 weeks from now. First, let's take a look at each one of these 7 last sayings of Jesus on the cross and see what those statements are whispering to us today. As we begin, it would be well to keep in our minds that our society today holds these same dynamics in principle that existed in Jesus' day, in the Jesus story. And whether we're talking about the rich subordinating the poor, the educated subordinating the uneducated, whites over non-whites, men over women, white women over non-white women, straight people over or either subordinating or extirpating those that are LGBTQ, or even when cisgender try to extirpate those that self-identify as transgender, we're living in the Jesus narrative every day. And if you're a theist, you have to ask yourself how your God defines holiness. Does your God look like Jesus's God? Or does your God look like the God of the Pharisees? Jesus had a definition of holiness that radically attracted and embraced those who were repelled and who steered clear of the definition of holiness that was being put forth by the priestly ruling class of Jesus' day along with the Pharisees. And I guess what I'm asking this week is that if you're a theist, does your God look like Jesus? And the answer to this question is at the heart of everything. If your theism is destructive or restorative, if your theism is inclusive or exclusive, attractive and inspiring or repulsive, one picture of God, one version of a God leads to annihilation and the other to a whole new world. Heart group application this week. I'd like you to actually go back and reread all four Gospels. It won't take you that long, and they're shorter than you think, but I want you to watch for the dynamics that I put forth this week and see if you see them at work in the narrative as well. Look for why the narratives themselves tell us that Jesus's ministry ended up on a Roman cross, and then we'll go from there next week. Number two, journal what you discover as you do this, and then number three, share with your heart group this upcoming week whatever it is that you write down. Until the only world that remains is a world where love reigns. Many voices, one new world. I love each of you dearly. I'll see you next week.